Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. And someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit.
The winter solstice is upon us, as is all the rest of winter. With that comes with holidays, long nights, cold, and snow. Today's theme is simple and obvious. It's winter. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. I have stories for you about snow and cold and darkness, the solstice and long nights. So let's just get right to it.
Snow.
Snow and ice are permanent features of the Arctic and the Antarctic. Not truly permanent winter, because the 24 hours of night alternates with 24 hours of day each year, but always cold, always ice. Poet Elizabeth Bradfield contemplates these lands, north and south, and did what a poet does, wrote about them, the places and the people who interacted with those places. This short collection for installment number one is about the unknown, unknowable lands of the Arctic and Antarctic, terra incognita.
More about the idea of traveling in strange lands than the idea of home, of venturing to foreign lands. So I'm going to read actually some poems, not from interpretive work, but from this new book of poems that's coming out next year that's all about Arctic and Antarctic exploration. I've never been to Antarctica, so this is truly terra incognita for me, but I've read a ton about it. I'm completely fascinated. I've spent a little time in the Arctic, not enough. But these are a few poems about exploring a strange place, about trying to fix your ideas about a location, both geographically and in terms of its history, that's away. So this first poem is called On the Longing of Early Explorers, and it has a short epigraph, which is it's just a fancy name for a little quote at the beginning of a poem. And this is something said by Pierre-Louis Moreau de Maupertuis in 1740. He said, "I would prefer 1 hour of conversation with a native of Terra Australis Incognita to one with the most learned man in Europe." And this is ironic because there is no native, there was never a native culture to Antarctica, human culture. On the Longing of Early Explorers. Before satellites eyed the Earth's whole surface through the peephole of orbit, before we all were tracked by numbers trailing from us like a comet's tail, oh, if only, they'd say in quaint accents and obscure sentence structures. If only the unsullied could be discovered. If only, once found, it could speak its own nobility and let us empathize. Poignant, the despair that itched beneath their powdered wigs, their longing to touch the unspoiled, their sense that the world was already ruined. So in thinking about Antarctica and these explorers, you run into a lot of really cool stories about place. And Antarctica, it's kind of like the The ideas about Antarctica are really similar, I think, in many ways to our ideas about the West. Vastness, expansiveness, tons to explore, a little bit of danger, a little bit of romance. This next poem is called The Third Reich Claims Neuschwabenland, 1939. And it springs from a true story. The Germans were very, very excited about controlling the sperm whale fishery grounds down in Antarctica right before World War II burst out, less for the meat of these whales than for the oil they produced, which was incredibly, incredibly fine oil that was prized for machinery specifically. So these were really, really valuable grounds, and I was reading about the history of the Third Reich in Antarctica and came across some of this. So this is a section poem. It's got three little sections to it. The Third Reich claims Neuschwabenland, 1939. 1. Ice is not land, so how to claim it? How to mark it owned without thatched roofs, artifacts from conquered tribes, quaint yeomen tilling non-native crops on the annexed shore? The plains Passat and Boreas were catapulted from the chill deck of the Schwabenland into the frigid, uncharted air to fly across the ice, 1/5 of the continent, and photograph it, 11,000 pictures, to drop their aluminum darts tattooed with a crooked cross every 20 miles into what they saw, as if they could fix it, as if they could pin it fast and point to it as theirs, here. Here, anchorages rich with whale oil, space on the map of the world, now called Neuschwabenland. On the shelf, skull of a fox, abalone shell, bundle of porcupine quills, my mnemonics of travel, of what I have discovered. I buy star BD035750 online and name it Incognita. There's a certificate that comes in the mail, a mythology, a map. Is this dog mine? She has begun some nights to growl, low and defiant, when I move her from the couch, hers. If my lover leaves me, what will become of our photographs and stories? Who will keep the dog? I claim the lips of Barb Brzezinski that night in the woods on Vashon before I knew that she was married. Ice is not land, is restless, and what was claimed has moved, is inching towards sea, has maybe broken off, calved from the frozen edge, and now trails its dust and shit and egg shards and abandoned fuel tins, trails what stories it held through the ocean's haloclines and thermoclines, its pelagic and benthic layers, scattering them across its seafloor. Maybe by now, one of the marked aluminum darts, tall as an emperor penguin, and dropped, 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 let loose in calculated transects, then stumbled over, perched on, nested under, scoured by wind, maybe scoured of its markings, thin and pocked. Maybe it is settling beneath miles of water, is crumpling, declarative not of claim, but of time. And then I just want to read one final Incognita poem. This is about the North instead of the South. There's this explorer, his name was Donald B. McMillan, and in 1925 he was the first guy to bring color film up to the Arctic. So this comes from that moment. Polar Explorer number 15, McMillan brings color film to the Arctic, 1925. Grease, ice, melon with algae, claret flows of pupping grounds. From the beginning, one man on every venture was issued brush and paint to translate what the strange sky, colors shifting in each breeze, pressed against his iris. But they had no palette, no dialect to describe the shawled earth, no Ainu, snow on ground, or Muranek, soft, deep snow, no Kensikek, snow floating on water, or Utbak, snow carved in block. No 100 words. In time, though, use and hue began to build a lexicon. Crevasses descend blue and haunting, avoid their quick release. When honey smears the bergs at waterline, rich ground for hunting. Pink in the petals of ice flowers, time to think again of home, where description of that long and foreign cold will be doubted. the red-swept sky, the minarets of ice, the blushing snow received not as what was seen, but what had been envisioned by men made mad. Macmillan thought he'd found his proof, but even Technicolor's objectivity, once home, seemed static, framed, absurd, chemicals warped no doubt by conditions beyond what they were made for. No lens yet can speak the vision of the overwhelmed eye at the time of seeing. I will never know what they hoped to see, what the vast light allowed them.
You can learn more about Elizabeth Bradfield and read more of her poetry at ebradfield.com. A sleepless night in a hotel room reminded Erin Jepsen of a sleepless night 6 weeks earlier, when she was also traveling. But instead of being in a warm hotel room, that memorable night was in a cold tent. And that reminded Erin of another cold, long night years before. The memories weave together in her story, Night Vigil.
Night Vigil. Weeping may endure for the night, but joy comes in the morning. Psalm 30, verse 5. Last night was a long night. Stuck in a hotel in Hermiston, Oregon, the last place on earth I desired to be. I fought to open my eyes when once again one of my children woke and cried. They both have colds, so one or the other was awake every hour, all night long. Head aching. I lay thinking about the different nights in my life that seemed even longer than this one. The feeling of cold hits me first, bone-penetrating cold that chills even the memory of the night at Swamp Lake 6 weeks ago. I lay huddled in a borrowed sleeping bag, its unfamiliar contours limp against my shivering body. Fumbling with numb fingers, I pull the drawstring tighter around my face in a vain attempt to construct a better barrier between myself and the freezing night air. The rain begins. I hear it hitting the tarp above my face, the sound like tiny dancing feet, the sound of rain on the roof of an old trailer I slept in as I snuggled my week-old daughter on the couch all night, holding her body against my chest, my body heat the only thing keeping her tiny frame warm. Those raindrops danced above my head. They danced on the roof of a tiny rental in Fresno, the night I lay waiting for news that my mom had died. I was 11, my new baby sister but 3 weeks old. The long-hoped-for and prayed-for baby lay in her laundry basket crib because the new cradle was not yet done. How my mother hated placing her new tiny treasure in a laundry basket. And now she was dying. Her face had gone gray after dinner and she had to go lie down. That was hours ago, and I lay still in the dark in bed waiting for the phone to ring. The dark presses on my open eyes, staring up at the unseen silver underbelly of the red tarp. Not my tarp. Someone gave me the tarp for the night to keep the freezing rain off my sleeping bag, and I had stretched it tight, hoping its shelter would keep me warm that night. I am not warm. I am shivering with the deep, gut-tightening clenching that makes me wish I had not eaten any of the green soup I cooked for dinner. That soup churns in my shivering gut. Take my mind away. With the rain comes tears. They are my own rain. The tears are my wetness that the tarp cannot stop, and they coat the inside of the limp sleeping bag. I cry for my babies, whom I miss desperately. I cry for the man I love who is far, far away. I cry for the loathing of the weakness that has once again betrayed me on the trail. I cannot stop the tears this time. As I lay in the dark long ago, I did not cry. I lay awake, listening to the baby in her laundry basket, breathing softly and waiting. Waiting without tears. Waiting for her to wake again. Waiting for the phone to ring. Waiting and trying not to see in my mind the face of my mother, drained of color, of her fainting slumped against the wall, of my dad's strong hands lifting her in her unsteady steps out to the car, of his hurried and jumbled words telling me nothing, of the words hospital and don't know and call you. Grandma will take care of you. I will call. I lay flat in the dark and waited. I lay on my back. Usually I sleep on my stomach. In a clinging cold bag, I cannot lay on my stomach and let the cocoon of sleep roll over me, so I lay on my back, my eyes open, staring at the cold as if it is something I can actually see instead of something I feel on my wet eyeballs. I lay on the ground, hard and cold and flat under my tarp, the red tarp in the dark that is not mine. I lay and wait for morning to come, for my salvation from the gut-churning cold and from missing my family. I lay and count the miles between me and home, home and warm, home and soft, and arms enfolding me, and small hands holding mine. So many miles, hundreds of miles, 1 mile for every minute of that interminable night. The minutes ticked by in the dark, and still the phone did not ring. I counted the miles, following in my mind the car as it drove to the hospital, wherever that was. The strong hands against my mother and the brightly lit windows of the emergency room pouring their garish fluorescence out into the quiet night. The grayness of her face, the scratching of a pen against paper. More minutes crept by as I lay in the dark on my top bunk 3 weeks after my 11th birthday, listening to my baby sister breathe. The red tarp seems to breathe. Air sucks it in and out above me, and I watch it in my mind, in and out, concave, convex, concave. Dancing footprints of rain have gone away, and in their place is stillness. Quiet, the sound of outdoors, where lurks the small noises of animals, the sound of space, the sound of the cold, which is everywhere, not just in touch, but also in sound. The sounds ought to bring fear, but instead they bring comfort. In a world where sight is blurry and unpredictable, sound is my lifeline, and prayer is my lifeline. Counting the miles between myself and the ones I love, I know that God is with both, and the thought brings comfort. I know that my prayers, whispered between shivering lips, still salty with a coating of tears, will reach them via the one who loves them even more than I. Many a night my prayers have been sent heavenward, but never so despairingly as the night I waited for my mother to die, as I waited for a phone call, as I waited to know what was wrong. I prayed. I did not believe that the fervency of my prayers would make any difference to a God who already knew the answer to the questions in my heart, but it did not stop me from praying them. I trusted God with the unshakable faith of an 11-year-old child, but even then, I did not expect the answer to necessarily be yes. I hoped, oh yes, how I begged God, but I knew it often is no. I knew even then that God gives us no's, and I was preparing my heart, protecting my heart from what I knew might be coming. The phone call never came, but at last morning did. Light crept into the room. The baby woke and needed to be fed. My dad, the sort of person who does not call unless he has something to say, never called. Grandma and I fed the baby. We still waited. Dawn creeps in slowly after a cold night. It seems stiff and creaky like an old cat who stretches herself upon waking, long and slow, working each muscle in turn. I wait, knowing there were still hours to endure before breakfast and a fire. Light comes into my tarp reluctantly, heat comes even more slowly. At last, voices. Someone is awake. I lay still, listening. Every sound made me look up, ears unconsciously waiting for news, for my dad, for a neighbor, something, anything. Without warning, the door opened and my dad came in, tired. He wanted the baby, he said. He needed to take the baby to the hospital to my mom. No, Mom had not died in the night. No, they did not know what was wrong. The doctors were running tests. He needed the baby. He needed her clothes and diapers and a car seat. He looked tired. I have to force stiff limbs to move. Tears still hover close, and I don't want to take them down to the campfire where voices dripped up to me on the blue haze of wood smoke. I push back the limp and slimy bag, half-heartedly extricating my aching limbs, my numb feet. I am now that cat, moving each stiff muscle as if I am swimming in syrup, thick and sticky and dragging at my body. I trudge a meandering path toward the voices. Voices hovered around me as I walked down the gray-carpeted hallway of the hospital. Hushed voices trickled from rooms beside me, breezy voices from behind me on the left where we had passed a nurse's station. I carried the three-week-old baby in my arms, her fiery red hair tousled against my shoulder, her warm limpness sinking into the crook of my elbow. Walking beside my towering father, I carried her carefully, looking up only when an old man passed us. "That your baby?" he asked. I shook my head no in wonderment and disgust. I was only 11. I still needed a mother myself. I was not the mother to the tiny bundle I carried. We arrived at her room. She lay in bed, on her back, like I had been while I waited. I did not cry as I handed the baby to her. I had not cried from fear, and I did not cry from relief now. She was alive, and she would live. She wasn't going to die, she explained to me. She'd almost died. There were blood clots in her legs, she said. She'd almost died when the ER doctor wanted to run a scope, but he hadn't done it. She'd almost died when the circulation had been completely cut off to both her legs, but she hadn't died. She would still have years of pain ahead, of therapy, of not being able to nurse my sister because of the blood thinners, of chronic fatigue from no circulation in her ruined veins. But she would live. She would live to watch my sister grow and to guide me through the turmoil of high school. A deep gratitude punctuated my prayers that night, knowing that God did not have to let her live. In the moment, gratitude feels as heartfelt for smaller things as it does years later for the larger. As I stand next to the fire at Swamp Lake, the gratitude fills me for the simple, life-sustaining warmth of sun, of fire, of people. Frost coats the slippery surface of rocks and the steep side of my red tarp. But it doesn't matter now. Every minute the sun reaches more of it, melting it away and warming the patches of grass. I still feel numb, outside and in, dreading the day's work ahead after a sleepless night, yet knowing that once I warm up, a kind of euphoria will hit, a triumph. It is over. The long, long night is over, and I made it. The long trek out looms ahead of me, but I know I will make it through that also. I am a different person than I was when I went to bed the previous evening, stronger and more vulnerable. This morning came all too quickly. My son, with his little nose running and his little whine unending, climbed up onto the hotel bed beside me. I asked and was informed that it was nearly 7. I knew in spite of my fuzzy brain that I needed to rise and begin my day, giving up hope of having any sleep. There was a family birthday party to attend, a 4-hour drive ahead with these same cranky children, and an evening event. No matter. It was morning, and whatever else the day held, it meant the long night was over.
This piece, Night Vigil, resulted from a women's backpacking and writing expedition that Erin took this past fall. More of Erin's work is at Whistler Erin, Whistler Erin, livejournal.com. Background music is Remains of the Day by Frozen Silence. Installment number 3. Ana Maria Roque goes around town to talk to people about winter sports.
There were 4 of us burning out in that sky. Snowflakes falling like white feathers.
I've only been snowboarding once, and that was 2 winters ago. So we did the Bunny Hill. But I think for the first hour, I couldn't really get out of the floor. I kept on falling on my ass over and over and over and over again. It really felt tougher on my self-esteem, more so than on my body, because it was so cold. And it was also late spring, so the snow was really crappy. Anyway, I think I made it down the Bunny Hill maybe 3-4 hours later. And I actually made it through the whole thing, and I was actually kind of kicking ass at it. So had I not been born in Brazil, where we don't have any snow, you know, maybe I'd have done this quite regularly. And the day after, I could feel exactly where I felt over and over again on.
Do you do any winter sports?
Yes, I snowboard, actually.
Are you good?
I think I'm pretty good.
How long have you boarded?
Since 6th grade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How was your first experience?
It was pretty funny, actually. Me and my dad and my brother and sister, we totally taught ourselves, so we were just bombing down the slopes, falling all over the place, but it was fun.
Do you still go, like, every year?
Yeah, I live in Sandpoint, so I go to Schweitzer. I have a season pass, so... Cool.
Do you do any winter sports?
No.
Not at all?
No.
Sledding, snowboarding, skiing?
No. I'm not a big snow person.
Do you do any winter sports?
No.
I've never skied, snowboarded.
I have skied, but I don't.
How was it?
I don't like it.
Is it cold or is it just...
Yeah, I just don't like cold.
Tell me about your first snowboarding experience.
Essentially, it was a lot of falling, a lot of hurting, and a lot of sliding down the hill, not on the board, maybe on my face.
When was this?
It was probably a good, like, 6 years ago now.
Are you pretty good now?
Yeah.
You go a lot?
I try to, but don't always get to go when I want to because it's expensive and far away.
Any other sports you've ever done?
For snow sports? Mm-hmm. Well, sledding, yeah, and tubing, but that doesn't really count. And tying a tube behind a truck.
Do you play any winter sports?
No, I don't. I want to try snowboarding, but maybe
why
until January.
Why do you want to try snowboarding?
It just looks fun.
You're not afraid of cold?
Oh, no.
No, not afraid of falling?
No, not at all.
How come you never tried it?
Maybe just because I never had anybody that does it until I got here and everybody's so into it.
Where are you from?
I'm from Oregon.
And there's no snowboarders in Oregon?
Well, not from where I grew up, no. No, nothing like that. Just all soccer, Latinos, so that's all we knew. That's all we did.
Have you ever tried any winter sports?
Yes.
What do you do?
Skiing.
Are you good?
No.
When's the last time you went?
Oh, probably 10 years ago.
Tell me about your first experience.
It was fun. I skied the first time in high school and had a great time. As you get older, knees get unhappy with skiing, so.
Did you ever want to try snowboarding?
Snowboarding did not exist when I was skiing, really, so.
Never too old to learn.
Yeah. Could be.
Have you ever tried any winter sports?
Yes.
What sport?
Downhill skiing, cross-country skiing, snowshoeing.
Do you still do them?
No.
Why not?
Spinners.
When's the last time you went?
4 or 5 years ago.
Can you tell me your funniest experience? Or what you loved about it?
What I loved about it? Mm-hmm. Probably what I hated about it.
That works too.
When I was in high school, I lived on the East Coast, and all the snow there is awful. And so my first trip up to a huge mountain at Sugarloaf, I had the bindings, that you know, those really long skis with the bindings, and I was at the very top of the mountain. I'd never been on a gondola before, and I lost my ski
on
the top of the mountain.
Oh.
That was one bad.
Did you get your ski back?
No.
Do you do any winter sports?
I do. I downhill ski and cross-country ski.
Do you still do it?
I do. I like to sled with my kids, too. Does that count?
That's a sport.
All right.
When's the last time you went?
Last winter. As you know, I went sledding with my kids 2 days ago.
How's that?
It was really fun, but we got really wet.
Well, that will
and
happen.
Freezing, so, yeah.
You do any winter sports?
Yes.
What do you do?
Snowboarding.
How long have you been snowboarding?
5 years.
Are you good?
I wouldn't say good, but...
Do you do jumps?
Yeah, I try, but I don't land any.
You don't land any? Can you do toe turns?
Yeah.
Tell me your funniest story.
Probably when I ripped my pants snowboarding, like up the seam of your butt.
No way.
Yeah.
I
think I fell. I'm not quite sure. Someone pointed it out to me like probably 4 hours later in the lodge. It
you
was
didn't
really
feel
bad.
The air coming in?
No. Well, I thought it was a little cold and a little drafty, but I just thought that was like the wind. But it was really bad because it looked like snow, and then some stranger pointed it out to me. But yeah, slightly embarrassing, but I guess it happens. I don't know.
Do you do any winter sports?
No, not really.
Not at all?
I just mostly sit in the lodge and wait for my boyfriend to come back.
Yeah. Have you ever tried it?
No, I don't really like the snow. It's really cold.
Yeah. Do you do any winter sports?
No, I don't.
None whatsoever?
No.
Ever tried?
No, I haven't. Simply just due to money. I haven't had money to go skiing or any of that kind of thing.
Skiing.
Snowboarding, snowshoeing.
How about sledding?
Occasionally, yes. Yes, yes.
That can be a sport.
Yeah.
It's a physical exercise.
It is a physical exercise. I would categorize that more not as a sport, but just as fun.
Fun.
Yeah.
It's a winter activity.
Yes.
Indeed. How about snowball fights?
Yes.
Are we kind of too old for that?
No.
No?
Not at all.
Not at all?
Not at all. It's a community building exercise, occasionally.
Like it.
That background music, it was called Snow. It's by Cynical Sense. Teresa Ruano could find little information about the winter solstice to satisfy her personal interest in the subject. There was no Wikipedia, for instance, back 12 years ago. So she collected what she could and decided to publish it all together using her favorite medium, the web. Teresa Ruano is a web writer and content designer, and when she was starting out, she had time and could use the site as a showcase for her talent. The site is candlegrove.com. The site took on a life of its own, and it's growing as contributors and researchers add to their subject of winter solstice, from astronomy to ancient celebrations and how they morphed into modern traditions. And now Candle Grove and Teresa are considered authorities on the subject of winter solstice, having been referenced by the New York Times, the Washington Post, Encarta Online Encyclopedia, and the Christian Science Monitor. From her home office in San Francisco, Teresa Ruano talked with me by phone last year for this next installment, installment number 4 of Yin Radio. Our show today is winter.
Thank you, Teresa Ruano, for joining me today, and thanks so much for spending some time with me.
My pleasure.
December 21 is usually the day of the winter solstice, and this is a time of year when people are celebrating around the world, really. And people have always celebrated this time of year throughout history and throughout prehistory. But can we start today by having you tell me just what is the winter solstice?
Well, the actual moment of winter solstice is caused by the planetary pose of the Earth as it orbits the sun. In the northern hemisphere, the point at which the sun actually is the lowest in our sky is the moment of winter solstice. And for the planet, the only place that has the sun directly overhead at the moment of winter solstice is around the Tropic of Capricorn, which is in the southern hemisphere. And this tilt is what causes our seasons and that moment of transition from losing sunlight to starting to gain sunlight again because of the position of the Earth and its tilt is that the moment of transition called winter solstice.
Now, usually we think of winter solstice, though, as a day. It's the shortest day or the longest night. But you're saying it's actually a moment.
Well, you know, the whole idea of the longest night is a little bit of a myth because actually the word solstice means standing still sun, and this comes from observation where the amount of daylight that we lose actually sort of stabilizes around this period of time, and so it if you measured it by seconds, perhaps it would be the longest night and the shortest day, but really there's a period of about a week to 2 weeks where, for most people in the northern hemisphere at least, it's fairly stable, and then we start gaining daylight after that period ends.
But we do know that that's a moment that's measurable at which we change from losing to gaining sunlight.
Yes, and that's the key to the whole idea around celebrating at this time of the year.
And did the ancients know this?
Well, I feel that they did. They spent a tremendous amount of effort to chart and observe the solstices. Some of the most enormous ancient structures, like Stonehenge, were built just to make sure that they knew when that moment occurred. And, of course, the theory is that there was ritual and celebration to help that process along that was tied into those structures. They may not have understood the whole idea of the planetary tilt and the astronomical cause of this transition point, but they were far more attuned, I think, to these seasonal transitions because it was a matter of life and death in terms of the cycle of growing food.
I had somebody ask me this the other day, and I think it's a really good question, but it might be kind of basic. You know, you just described a position of the Earth relative to the sun and shortest. Why do people celebrate that?
Well, I think that it tied very deeply into the ancient idea is that we do need to help this along. And of course, for modern humans, we've forgotten all of that, but I think there is also the fact that we really can't escape our biology, and that our bodies are tied into this cycle, the diurnal cycle of day and night. And it's pretty well known that the less daylight there is and the more darkness there is, the more people struggle with seasonal affective disorder. And so there's a sense of relief, I think, even if it's buried way, way back in our biology, when we realize that the days will start to grow longer again and the warm weather is returning and all of the things that that seasonal transition mean to us at a very deep level.
It does seem that people celebrate it all over the place, whether it's celebrated as solstice or, of course, some other festival. It's a big festival time. So let's talk a little bit about how people celebrate the winter solstice or events surrounding the winter solstice, because also our modern traditions come from those ancient ones that have been handed down and modified.
Oh, absolutely. Christmas is a transplant over many different kinds of festivals that occurred at this time of the year. And many of the things that we do as a part of the symbols and the decorations and the rituals that have become part of our tradition come from those more ancient celebrations. It's certainly true of evergreens and of candles and of introducing extra beautiful lights. Gift giving is something that reaches way, way back to thousands of years, to well before Christmas. I think that one of the things that fascinates me about this time of the year is that the things that we want to do as a tradition have far more universal origins than a lot of people realize, and that makes it more inclusive and makes it also more open for people of all kinds to create meaning out of a celebration at this time of the year.
It seems to me, and it might be just from where I sit in my life and my worldview, it seems that winter solstice is kind of being rediscovered. And that maybe as people are looking to make the winter holidays more meaningful, more personal, perhaps more spiritual. What kind of trends are you seeing?
Well, I absolutely agree with you. And again, it may just be because I'm looking for that, because I started this process 12 years ago and created a website about it and have continued to learn more over that time. But I think one example of this is the reissue a couple of years ago, I think it was actually almost 10 years ago, of a very old book called 4,000 Years of Christmas. And this, you know, this is just one example, I think, of I think a growing awareness that the season of Christmas is, and I think a growing hunger and a growing desire to really find meaning, because we're confronted with so much that many of us want to shape and filter out and try to create something that makes sense to us and that isn't all about buying things and isn't all about just doing things because they've always been done, but has some emotional and spiritual connection to what's important to us.
Can you think of an example of some of the creative ways that people have celebrated the solstice?
Well, it's interesting because some people choose to make the solstice sort of a peaceful, solitary, self-reflective preparation for Christmas. And other people center the celebration that, you know, having people over, doing some kind of a party with a little bit of ritual right around the winter solstice. So it really ranges. I mean, one person, you know, decided that night they would light 100 candles and, you know, put them down their pathway. Other people just go out and observe the sunset or the sunrise and think about the year and let the previous year go and think about their intentions for the coming year. Other people, you know, very much want somehow to be more connected with nature. There's just a huge range of things that people have written in to talk about the way that they celebrate solstice. There's one very simple ritual where, and we do this in my family, we turn out the lights and we sit in front of the fire and we pass around an orange and we each peel a little piece of the orange off and we think about what from the previous year we want to say goodbye to. And then we pass around the orange again, and we each take a segment of the orange to eat, and we think about what we want to set as an intention for the next year. And then that's it. We enjoy the darkness for a little while and listen to music and just have that sense of peace from in the deepness of the darkness of that night.
I thank you very much for talking with me, Teresa.
Oh, my pleasure, and blessings of the season to you and your listeners.
Teresa Ruano, creator of CandleGrove.com. Learn more about winter solstice at CandleGrove.com. Winter solstice. We celebrate the night, the greatest darkness of the year. The sun will soon return, but on this evening, we celebrate the night. My eyes fail as the dim invites fear, but I know the dark is equal to the light. I release fear. I remember how to walk in the dark, embrace the night. My senses wake. The smell of the pine when brushed delights my nose. The smell of the crisp air is clean in the back of my throat. I swear I can smell the very stars. Bold tastes come alive, and my mouth relishes cheese, red wine, beets, garlic and onions, lentils and meat, squash and apples, chocolate and oranges. These are the tastes of the night. The tingle of cold creeps into my cheek. Later by the fire, I'll feel the fingers of heat caress my skin, making it thrill. I hear the crunch of my steps on the frozen ground. The owl screech raises the hair of mice and dogs. A muffler of snow lies deep. I listen to the silence. Up next on this Yin Radio Winter Show, we have more poetry from Elizabeth Bradfield. She's reading from her collection called Interpretive Work, as well as her second book of poems, Approaching Ice. Approaching Ice will be published in 2009. This set of poems she's reading next for installment number 6 takes us to the landscapes of Alaska.
I want to read, I think, mostly about Alaska, where I lived for the last 5 years. Not long enough. And the effects of that landscape, which is Alaska part of the West? I don't know. This is a disagreement lots of people have. That, you know, that really cool publication, High Country News, I was talking with them about doing some book reviews, and I was like, oh, there are great books coming out of Alaska. How about if I profile a bunch of Alaskan authors? And they're like, not really Western. So, these definitions that we have are curious, and, you know, I grew up in the wet West, and that's a different West as well. But this poem is called Getting Out. And I mentioned, do they have skijoring here in Idaho? For those of you unfamiliar, it's very fun. You strap on skis and you put yourself into a climbing harness or whatever, and it's got a line out from it, and you're hooked up to a dog, usually a trained sled dog, that pulls you along. So you can get over some great ground skijoring. Getting out. How in love with myself I was on the iced over river. Alaska range sprawled miles around, skiered trails of snow machines across the low hills, spruce and spruce, and a few hours of thin blue sky the day. Laced into three pins, sweating in the perfect 10 above, ski-jore harness snug on my hips, at last I was in this February, air silent of most birds, not in Anchorage's Tacomaness, its five lanes and conveniences, but on skis in the mountains, an old dog pulling me toward a cabin of logs, its weather door a thorning of nails, point out to deter bears. Do you know this moment? When you expand at last from the clench of the daily, find yourself bodily glad, at last discovering pride, or whatever word we don't have for such pure chest bursting, not something to be stuffed into a pocket, but vast and permissible. And then I want to read a poem, a historic poem about Vitus Bering, who, along with Steller, came across from Russia and was the first European to really say, oh, you know, there's a lot of land up there. And of course, for many years, Alaska was a Russian holding, and Bering and Steller kind of kicked all of that off. Legacy for Vitus Bering. They've closed again the gap that you first sailed, Russian-sponsored Dane, so cousins on the Diomedes are in post-Cold War touch. But you made the map that made the border, citing lands just guessed at between Kamchatka and America's west coast. And we write history from what's put down officially, maps and logbooks made and kept by the survivors of your death, of your loss of ambition from years line-towing across the forehead of Siberia. Finally, you set sail for glory, or not for, but from whatever pushes us beyond our birth spots. What pushes us away? I, too, have left for some spot unknown by any who claim me, for place unhooked from kin and story. I've fled the watched life of any hometown where if you kick a dog, infect a girl, break a window, the girl turns out to be your mother's landlord's cousin, the dog a beat cop's mutt, and pain shards cut your sister's foot. Each chafed at thing a window in your glass house world. So the age-old lust for places we pretend are free of consequence. It's the same now as it was with Oedipus, poor stiff, running to escape his fate and running smack dab into it. An awful scene, a nightmare warning we need to keep repeating because, of course, fate never seems immediate. For weeks, Bering's crew feasted on the delicious bulk of sea cows, now extinct. They played cards, anteed up with otter pelts that Promyshleniki later stripped from the shores. Foxes bit the men's toes at night. The land ate them as they ate the land, calling it need, worrying about it later. And then I guess the other, I thought I was going to read one. I'm going to read a different one instead. I want to read this poem that I read in Stephen Yolder's class today. It's called Multi-Use Area. So in Alaska and in many states, you have these areas that are set aside to be multi-use areas. Sometimes they're wildlife refuges, but you can go take photographs, you can go bird watching, you can run your four-wheeler, you can do some target practice. And I got a little bit tired of my own self-righteousness, I think, before writing this poem, and how my ideas of how wilderness should be properly enjoyed. So I thought, okay, let me point the picture back at myself a little bit. Multi-use area. With the day on the hay flats, sun slight through clouds, grasses just starting again from last year's grasses, geese and cranes bugling over the marsh, have been better without the old tires, the gutted couch in a pullout, a moose slumped alongside, meat taken, but the head still attached. I can close my eyes to the pop bottles, booze bottles, and orange skeet shells in the parking lot, along the river, walk past them. I can pretend my own steps through the marsh convey a different presence, but I can't close my ears. There, a white-fronted goose. There, a pintail, willow branches cracking underfoot, F-14s from the base, and there, again, the shotgun blast and whoop, which I can't edit out, which I probably shouldn't. It stops when I walk into view. I stop and stare across the flats through my binoculars, thinking, ask. And of course, someone staring back at me over a truck bed, thinking, ask. That's Alaska. That's the West. Thanks very much.
Poet Elizabeth Bradfield is a Wallace Stegner Fellow in Poetry at Stanford University. The poems on today's show are from a public reading at the University of Idaho in October earlier this year. Check out ebradfield.com. Our last installment comes from Anna Maria Roque, who shares winter memories from Moscow, Idaho.
Last year, winter came early and overstayed its welcome, like an unwanted guest. There hadn't been such severe winter in decades. School closed, road closed, even the university closed. It made me wonder if Moscow was named after the Russian capital for its cold winters. So as the first snowflakes came flurrying down the gray sky, I did not welcome them with childlike delight, but rather with the annoyance as thoughts of cold, wet pant legs, bad driving conditions, and darkness came to mind. A few days later, it was full-on winter. Temperatures below zero, plowing through snow to get to campus, slippery roads and all. The insides of my apartment windows frosted over, and in a matter of days a layer of ice started forming, and I wondered if it would have the same isolation effect as an igloo. Instead of finding out, I turned on the heater, which filled the apartment with suffocating burning smell since it hadn't been used before. But winter was here, and so there's nothing we could do about it. Instead, we take out our scarves, hats, and down coats and curse the cold as we bundle up. Once finals started dwindling down and the stress came off, a sunny morning was before me. I bundled up for a walk to downtown Moscow. Despite its cold and harshness, the snow still has a certain enchantment. It never fails to amaze me with the quietness it brings in the early morning. All the noise in the world muffled, dampened by the fresh white blanket. Nothing but the sound of the crunching of snow under my feet as I make the first tracks in the new layer of snow. I watch my breath as I take a deep breath in and out. Everything is covered by a thick white coat, which makes it all seem a little less harsh. Friendly, even. The steam plant releases thick billows of steam, making their way up to merge with the snow clouds hanging overhead. A sign that it will continue to snow as it has for days. The initial shivering vanishes as I walk briskly. God, I love mornings like this. It makes peace seem possible, as we find ourselves wanting to cuddle up to someone. In the dark, the cold can seem bitter and lonely, but in daylight, as Mother Nature hides the harshness of this world under a blanket of purity, cleanliness, and beauty, loneliness masquerades as hope. I hear a distant sound of sirens, which with these driving conditions becomes awfully common. I think back of my own accident 2 years ago, as I was driving to Boise. My parents had called worried about the snowstorm and the fact that it was getting late. But with only 2 more hours to go, I would be home by 1 a.m., and I just wanted to be home already and sleep in my own bed. Should have listened to my parents, because less than 30 minutes later, I was climbing out of my car, totaled at the side of the road, after having spun multiple times, rammed into a mountain twice, and taken down a sign, and then came to a halt, tipped on its passenger side in 5 feet of snow. Black ice. Now I wonder how the conditions will be in a few days as I go home to my parents for Christmas. I walk past a grassy hill that certainly would make a fun sled ride, and I see that people made jumps the day before. Little individual moguls. They remind me of the Black Mogul trails in Austria, where my siblings and I accidentally ended up in an advanced skier class, although we could barely even stand comfortably on skis. I wasn't cold for a single second throughout those days, sweating profusely out of nervousness and praying to God that I would make it down the hill alive. That's when I learned that one can talk oneself into pretty much anything, even pretending to know how to ski while going down a very steep hill at record speed because you can't figure out how to stop besides falling. "You're quite the speed devil," I remember the instructor saying at the bottom of the hill, not noticing how badly my legs were shaking, and I just gave him a faint smile. Now as I'm walking and laughing at myself, I make a mental note to check the status on Brundage and Bogus Mountain, wanting to go skiing. Even just playing in the snow sounds like fun. So I scoop up a handful of snow and form it into a ball. Ah yes, sticky snow, perfect for building snowmen. I quickly glance around and chuck the ball at the stop sign ahead of me. Missed. Sometimes I miss the childlike enthusiasm. I know that had we had so much snow 12 years ago, my twin and I would have been up at the crack of dawn, jumping up and down in our poofy little snowsuits, begging our parents, "Can we go? Can we go? Can we go?" And then playing outside all day, only to come in with rosy cheeks for some hot cocoa and food. You see, while winters may be bleak and harsh, our memories are also often filled with laughter, warmth, sharing, and joy. I reach my destination, and my friend greets me. "Walk with me," I say. "Share with me your memories."
Anna Maria Roque with Winter Memories and music from Rob Koslow. I'm closing this Yin Radio program with music from Janie Snyder. It's called The Healing Snow. You can contact Yin Radio at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Or find us on MySpace. Catch past shows, get podcasts, and subscribe to our e-newsletter for information about upcoming shows and Yin Radio news. All of this at yinradio.org. Yin Radio is now heard on community stations around the country. And I want to send a big Merry Christmas and Happy Solstice to everyone in Spokane, home of KYRS, Cottage Grove, Oregon, home of KSOW. To you Appalachians finding us via thedetour.us and WETX. Into Grand Rapids, Michigan via WPRR Public Reality Radio. And to Boise Community Radio at radioboise.org. And of course, love and kisses to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, and my fellow Muscovites in cold and snowy Moscow, Idaho. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho by VP Foundation and by me. I'm Sandy Billings. Thank you for joining me. Until next week. With the boogie band.